little large mass. It's like a, it's bigger than a golf cart, you know, that slides along the station that they've got to use. They've got to do it, and they've got to do it before the Progress spaceship comes up. Also scheduled to launch tomorrow. Let me drop it. Okay, and the other breaking news type of thing that came out, SpaceX was planning to launch Falcon 9 up to around 400 miles in altitude to put 11 satellites in space. And it's been delayed a couple of different days for different reasons on the pad. They're trying to get everything all squared away. In fact, it was going to go off finally tonight, right after the beginning of the net. But it turns out they're going to wait another 24 hours, which is tomorrow, probably around 8:30. They're going to launch the rocket to be, they'll finally get back to flight after the June explosion that they had when they were going up to the ISS with cargo. Now, the plan all along has been to bring the booster back, the first stage booster. And there was speculation they were planning on landing it back at Cape Canaveral, even so that they have a barge out in the ocean that they might use as well. They just finally got final approval from the FAA. Tonight they finally got their final approval to do just what they wanted to do, bringing it back to Cape Canaveral. They're gonna land it on a launch complex. It used to be Launch Complex 13. SpaceX took it over, and now they're not calling it a launch complex. They're calling it a landing complex. Landing Complex Number 1. Number 13, it's been abandoned since the 1970s, but they used to use it in the 1960s quite a bit. In fact, that was the same launch complex that they launched the first orbital lunar mission from Earth back in the 1960s. So it should be interesting to see if they succeed in bringing this thing back. There's quite a bit of other space news, Dick, but I don't know if you want me to go on. We'll turn it over to you. This is WS2N.
I think I saw this week one of the boosters did come back down facially and land on its tail. Isn't that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Was back in November. That was by Blue Horizon. Blue Origin. Blue Origin has a spacecraft and rocket called New Shepard that they launched from Texas, from western Texas. And they launched it to suborbital into space, a little over 60 miles high. The capsule separated from the booster, came back on parachutes, and the booster itself came back under thrust, and the rocket reignited and landed vertically. But this is SpaceX, a little bit different. You got to remember, this booster, this whole rocket they're launching is 229 feet high. It's actually taller than the whole stack of the, if you're going to put it up against the space shuttle, it's about 50 feet longer than the whole stack on the space shuttle. It's a big rocket capable of putting large satellites into geosynchronous orbit. And now with the systems that they're using, bring it back to land for reuse. So if that happens, that will be the first time something is set to orbit, and yet being able to reuse the first stage. Back to Dick.
I think I got a total of six astronauts on the International Space Station at this time, and I think that's going to be essentially that status for the next 6 months. Is that true, Paul?
There were our six last week. Soyuz was launched from Baikonur in Kazakhstan, and they put three more cosmonauts on board. Actually, three more astronauts, one American, one cosmonaut, and one guy from the European Space Agency. And three of them, they're actually all hams. You've got one guy from the European Space Agency, Tim Peake. He's going to, he's going to call us KG5B.
My friend, you're talking too much. My friend, you're talking too much.
And then,
what are you guys saying?
American. I believe it's the guy from the European Space Agency is going to be the first guy to get a chance to use the 2.4 gigahertz transmitter for digital TV, amateur radio. He's going to be in a way when he's up there. I imagine they just got up there and, they got this emergency EVA that the American has to do. Him and Scott Kelly, who's been up there, he's going to be up there for a year. He's going to go out there tomorrow to free up this mobile transporter. It's going to carry a situation. They got a Progress ship going up tomorrow as well. They can't bring that up until the mobile transporter thing is fixed. Whole ISS actually has to move, has to translate in space before they dock with the Progress, and they can't have this mobile transporter thing that's stuck between two locations that it's supposed to be stuck in the middle. Not a safe situation for the mobile transporter. Back to you, Dick.
Give us a couple words on that one, Paul. Is the mobile transporter sort of like the Canadian arm? Is that movable arm device that's on the ISS? Is that the thing that's stuck between stations, so to speak? Over to you, Paul.
The mobile transporter device is like a train. It's on two tracks, and I guess the tracks are probably a meter and a half wide from one another. So it's a 6-foot by 6-foot square, probably 4,000-pound rig that has to go from one end of the ISS to the other. Along the length of the truss segments, not the length of the living quarters, but this truss section that supports everything, including the solar panels and the radiators and all the equipment. So this device is on wheels, on this track, and it doesn't move too fast. Ground controllers usually move it, and let's say you want to transport the arm, the Canadian robot arm, to, or Dextra, another robotic thing, from one end of the ISS to the other, from the starboard side to the port side. You would use this little train on top of this car that goes back and forth. There's four connection pieces, and that you could attach the Canadian robot arm onto. And let's say you needed to do work all the way out on the port side, you needed to get astronaut equipment out there, you would send the train all the way down to the one end to as far as it could go, and then the 50-foot robotic arm would be able to reach and go to different spots. Canadian robot arm is capable of actually, inchworming its way from one end to the other. But, naturally, a transporter is the way to go. The problem is, if you wanted to carry, it can't carry weight at the same time. So it needs to be in these different modes. That's what this thing does. It relocates things from one end to the other, including a crew. You know, you can have the crew ride on this thing. Doesn't move fast. Maybe, they said one and a half meters per minute. So I think it's something like, you know, 1 centimeter per second or something. So it's not a fast thing. It's mostly operated by the ground control, so the crew could be indoors, you know. There are 6 people on board the space station, and they don't even have to know about it yet. Could have the ground crew moving this transporter from one end to the other, getting ready for, installation of something, or removal, or installation of a cargo vehicle that's coming up. So it's pretty much done regularly by ground control without the use of the astronauts. And that's what they were doing the other day, and they were moving from one location to another. You know, like there's 10 permanent spots that they could move this to. The reason they have these permanent spots is for structural strength and for there's power that goes through the transporter to the arm, and power and data connection. And there's 10 locations along the ISS that you could do this. So they got halfway between one and the other, and ground control realized, stop. They got a signal that said no good. Some thinking about it. They think maybe one of the brakes is poor brakes. Maybe something is activated inadvertently during the last spacewalk. So they'll send these two guys out, take a look at that, and hopefully it's quick fix by doing that. If not, they'll have to get further into it. They could look into each individual wheel, take covers off, and see if something's hanging up or what the problem is. They need to straighten this out before the progress of the ship gets up there about 2 days from now. Progress is going to take about 2 days. Usually it takes 6 hours, but they're going to take the slow route this time. They need a little time to get this mobile transporter back in operation. KTRIWS, come on.
Now, Paul, does the mobile transporter have its own battery supply? Is it only being charged when it's on one of the 10, when it's located at one of the 10 designated stations? And it plugs into something? Or is there some kind of a long cable? Wonder if there's a possibility if in between stations, when it's running on batteries, the batteries ran out. So how is it powered in between stations, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, to make it move, it has a reel. The reel, I don't think it's located. The reel is off to one side of the ISS, attached to the ISS, but then the cable comes out and attaches to the mobile transporter. That's enough to, actually move the transporter, power the transporter from one end to the other, but that's not what powers. Let's say you have an arm attached to it, or you have some piece of equipment that came up that needs to be powered, like they did with the that telescope that they went up there, the magnetic resonance telescope, that needs power, so they'll attach it temporarily to, let's say, the mobile transporter. And then at one of these 10 locations, it will be receiving power, not from that cable, but, through another connector when it parks at these different parking points. That's how it gets the power. And the same for the arm. If you're going to operate the arm, the arm needs power. But the arm has its power in these 10 different locations. You can't stop in the middle and have the arm working. The power will, from the cable, from the reel, will move the transporter back and forth. But to actually power and use and have data connections for the arm, you have to be in one of these 10 locations. Back to you there.
It sounds like when you get to one of the locations, there's some kind of a servo mechanism that moves a connector which plugs in this mobile transporter. Therefore, it has ISS power available to it. So there's some kind of a an elevator-like mechanism that brings a connector together when you're at one of the 10 stations? Is that roughly how it works, Paul? KQLAW?
You see the interface for that, but that's part of the, there's a top half of this mobile transformer, or transporter, and then the bottom half, I think we call the base mobile transporter, and then the regular mobile transporter has on top has all the, you know, robotics and everything for connecting the arm and any other types of auxiliary equipment that they want to attach to it. And the bottom part has the interface, so I don't know, it looks like, you can see four areas where the wheels are, and they have covers over it, so you really can't see the wheels, and probably down in that area they have something to, that order, it's definitely automatic that connects to it, some kind of connector that does that. You know, it's not like it's, powered through the rails, 600 volts going through a, through the rails of a subway car or something, and that's how you get all your power. But, it's different locations along the ISS that they can do that. And I think it travels almost, it's at 108 meters, so, 300 feet, this thing can go one way or the other. Normal location is right now, roughly in the middle of the whole setup. Not on the port side, not on the starboard side, roughly in the middle, right where Destiny is. Destiny is the American module. That's the main location. That's pretty much where it is now. It's off, off to one side. We have different numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it's stuck between the 2 and the 4 location. If there was a 3, it would be there.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
To do the EVA, the Quest Lab is pretty close to the zero truss section.
This thing is on wheels that move on tracks. If it was a railroad car, gravity keeps the wheels on the tracks. In this case, are those tracks really gears? And I presume there's an idler set of wheels that reaches around to the back side of the track with a spring loading to keep those wheels thoroughly engaged. In other words, in the case of a well-designed roller coaster car, the wheels are really captured onto that rail. They can't easily leave the rail. I'm guessing that's what's going on in this case. What's your guess as to how those wheels interface with those rails that pull? It sounds like an interesting device. I'm amazed we haven't heard more about it up till now. We're not as close to it as you are, and I think the general public doesn't know about this machine that can travel 100 meters at roughly 1 centimeter per second. That means it takes 100 seconds to go 1 meter, and it would take 100 of those. It's going to take 10,000 seconds to go from one end to the other. That's a couple of hours. Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Yeah, they said 1.5 meters per minute. So, pretty close to the same numbers what you're talking about. How that works out, I think it's, somebody said a centimeter per second, but the actual number is 1.5 meters per minute. Let's divide 16 to that. You can do it, but astronauts can actually disconnect it and move it from one end to the other. There's actually 5 brakes. There's 2 manual, what are they called? 2 manual brakes, and then 2 dynamic brakes. 1 main brake that you can disconnect the whole thing and roll it from one end to the other. And they have the capability of it. Let's say one wheel is gone and it's shot. They could actually disconnect that, reinstall another one. Not tomorrow, but if they see there's a problem. They do want to get it to a location so that there's a main brake that they can release. It's actually pushed a design where astronauts can push it along manually without power. So I'm sure they'll get it to, to the main location. Another idea of getting to one of the 10 locations is, the frame of this whole setup is all aluminum. What the tracks are made of, I don't know. But I've seen the tracks, and they look like channel iron. It's not angle iron. It looks like channel iron. So the wheels are probably, in between those, that, it's probably channel iron as it goes. That's where it came from. you know, things into the track. I can't see it that close. Should have paid more attention about, I think it was first installed in 2003.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The lifespan, yeah, maybe the lifespan's coming to an end. Back to there.
Yeah, the wheels being in a channel track captures the wheels in three dimensions, in three directions. But the fourth direction, the wheel can still slip out of the track. So there must be an arm with another wheel on the back side of that channel to keep it captured. Does that sound reasonable, Paul? Somewhat like the mechanisms they've got on roller coaster wheels to make sure the roller coaster cannot leave the track. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it looks like, there's four wheels. It's a big square thing, so if you got two tracks and two channels, both channels looking away from one another. The way it looks anyway. Now, you know, you can't translate something left or right. You know, if you translate it left, the wheels are going to hang up. They're not going to go that way. You know, so, yeah, similar to a roller coaster. And I'll be interested to see what happens. And if they fix it up real quick, they're going to have some get-ahead work that they could do. They're still getting ready for the EIDA, the International Docking Adapter, to come up. That was blowing up, when SpaceX was, Cygnus and SpaceX was both blew up, one in October and one in June, and one of those was going to have the International Docking Adapter on board. So that blew up, and that'll be able to get ready for data, power, different connections that have to be made for that. So if this goes well, they'll be able to look at it. Right now, they're only planning for a 5-hour EVA. Usually, they plan for six or seven. We'll see how they do. And my guess is the brake is going to be, you know, engaged, and they're going to undo the brake, and that's going to be it. Too bad they can't get a camera out there for a closer look. They got to do this manually.
Yeah, the magic number that you just said, magic information, was that the two U channels are facing each other. Therefore, one set of wheels are aimed to the right, one set of wheels are aimed to the left, so to speak, to engage those channels, and therefore it's captured. I'm going to make a guess that each of those wheels are being turned at close to 1 centimeter per second. They're being turned by something like a gear motor. And if the astronauts can push it manually, it sounds like there must be a way of freewheeling those gear motors. Maybe they've got a clutch plate that can be disengaged. So I'm wondering how the astronauts can manually move this. Any idea how that works, Paul? K2IW? Sounds like a fascinating device.
I know there was a fifth, you know, lever. There's four different levers down by each wheel. And that engages or disengages brakes. And they're supposed to be, you know, left in the unlocked position so that they can move whatever ground control wants to make it move. I think Scott Kelly might have not, he was supposed to put it into a certain location on his last EVA, and, you know, inadvertently might have moved, maybe hit it with his foot or something, and they don't know, because that was, you know, a couple of weeks ago. It's the first time they decided to move the mobile transport since then, and they only wanted, you know, put it to and locked up. this should be interesting. I'll follow this tomorrow. They'll have it live on the NASA channel. It's interesting. You have this Falcon 9 going up probably tomorrow as well. Not going to the space station, but launching satellites. And because that has nothing to do with NASA, it's amazing that, you know, NASA doesn't even report on their NASA site that SpaceX is sending a rocket up tomorrow. It's all independent. They rent launch complex number 40 from where they're going to launch from. They rent out this new launch complex. It used to be launch complex number 13, and now it's landing complex number 1, essentially owned by SpaceX. Because that's all private, you know.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A special deal with SpaceX and Qualcomm, putting the satellites in space. Basically, if you go to space, the NASA website, you know, you'll see all about the proposed EVA tomorrow. You'll see about Jason 3, the satellite that's going to be put into space from California next month by SpaceX. You might even see articles about the next cargo mission by SpaceX to the space station. But you'll not see one word, not one word about tomorrow's launch. And hopefully they make history by bringing the booster back to right back to Cape Canaveral. You know, it's kind of weird. You know, I mean, you have to go to what different websites to get these kinds of information about, you know, tomorrow's launch. Everybody complains about the NASA budget. You know, oh, by the way, the budget was approved. Usually they get around $18 billion. They got a little over $19, almost $20 billion. So they got a lot more money than they figured on. And the science people are real happy. They could, you know, for instance, there's a proposed mission to go to back to Jupiter. You know, it's called the Europa Express. And the scientists are real thrilled about this. They were going to have a spacecraft go that, you know, close flybys of Europa, but now they can afford, and they'll put this into the mission, a lander. They want to be able to actually send a lander down. Now, looks like they might have enough money to do that now. But long story short, some of these missions that are going up, you know, we're not paying for it. It's a private deal between SpaceX and whoever their customer is. Back to you.
One of the things you would be interested in, I'm not sure whether or not you get Scientific American, Paul. I just received yesterday the January 2016 issue of Scientific American. There's a nice article in there about the search for near-Earth objects, the asteroids and comets that in theory could crash into the Earth, and the next one that does, well, we had one a couple of years ago. It was I think they said an 18-meter diameter object crashed into Russia and injured a large number of people. When that thing entered the atmosphere, created a shockwave that broke a lot of windows. Didn't kill anybody, but created a lot of injuries. A lot of people got hit with broken glass because of the shockwave. Congress has charged NASA with the responsibility of finding all of the near-Earth objects above a certain size. That's the good news. And NASA has sort of accepted that responsibility. However, Congress did not yet supply enough funding for that to take place. So it is taking place, but at a much slower rate, with much less hardware, and therefore, will we find them in time? Is one question to ask. Thank goodness the number of impacts that we get per century is a very small number. But the Tunguska experiment, the Tunguska incident in Russia around the turn of the 1905, 1910 or so, when that event occurred. Let me drop this. Obviously, there was no method of detecting that before it came, and it created a lot of damage in an uninhabited area, thank goodness. But when you do discover a near-Earth object that sometime in the future has a trajectory that's going to give us an Earth impact, what do you do about it? Okay, the science fiction movies that we have seen, is you fly a rocket up there, you put a bomb alongside, and you explode the bomb, and you steer it up to some other direction. Sounds good. There's a problem. The biggest, most powerful bombs you and I know about are atomic weapons. A thermonuclear weapon, a hydrogen bomb, for instance, getting a megaton of equivalent explosion out of that is real easy. How river. You explode one of those in space, don't get anywhere near the same reaction. What we all forget about is a thermonuclear device exploded in the Earth's atmosphere gives you a tremendous amount of heat. It gives you a great big rising mushroom cloud, gives you a huge shock wave, knocks down everything in the environment, and creates a radiation burns, heat burns, all kinds of nasty things happen in the near environment. The majority of what that bomb does, let me drop. The majority of what it does is to issue a whole lot of extremely high velocity neutrons. Those neutrons hit the atmosphere and heat the atmosphere. That's where the majority of the heat of a nuclear device comes from. The high speed neutrons hitting the atmosphere. If there ain't no atmosphere because you're exploding it in space, you get a lot of neutrons, you don't get the mushroom cloud, you don't get the shock wave, you don't get the heat. You get a blast of neutrons. So if you explode a nuclear device alongside of a comet or asteroid, that you want to push it in some other direction, what you might end up doing is hitting that side of the, let's call it a asteroid, you hit that side nearest to the bomb with a huge blast of neutrons, you heat up the soil on that side, and if that was dry soil, it'll just sit there and glow. If the soil contains moisture, yes, you're going to vaporize the moisture, and you're going to get a huge amount of vaporized moisture expanding real fast. The steam you make is going to give you the equivalent of a blast. But if it's dry soil you're hitting, you're going to heat up the soil, but you're not going to get the normal blast. We forget about where the heat comes from in a nuclear device. Remember reading that on one of the websites in the last week or so. That was quite a surprise to me. I wonder if that's a surprise to you, Paul, on the assumption that it's accurate. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, no, that's no surprise. I've thought about it, but I know that idea has gone out the window, you know, many years ago. One movie, they drill a hole in the asteroid, and they put the nuclear bomb in on the inside. You know, that would do something, you know. But now instead of having one big thing coming toward the Earth, you might have hundreds of big things coming toward the Earth. So they need to find other ways to redirect it. But yeah, I know what you mean. If you have a big blast, there's no atmosphere to move around to get hot. Like putting a big flashlight out there, and that's about all you're going to get. Yeah, at the time, I wanted to mention one other thing about last week's net. We talked about the Cygnus spacecraft docking with the International Space Station. It's attached to it now, and they're presently unloading, over 7,000 pounds of stuff, food, material. A couple of the items that they sent up on the Cygnus. The first time since the shuttle retirement were these tanks, and they're large tanks, you know, maybe about, 4 feet long, a couple feet in diameter, each one, and, some tanks have oxygen in it, and some tanks have nitrogen in it, and they need to resupply, the space station, so they...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Eventually, the oxygen has to be replenished. They can't do it 100%. The same with the nitrogen. There's always a little, loss involved. They sent these tanks up to 6,000 psi. Let me drop it. That's what they put into these tanks, 6,000 pounds per square inch. A normal oxygen tank would be only 3,000 psi. So, they had a crew of about 40 or 50 people working on these things. When they were charging it, they had back on Earth, when they were setting this all up, and even all their test equipment before they got involved. And when they did it, as they were testing, they would put barricades up, and they'd be about 40, 50 feet away from this thing. Nobody would be standing on top of it when it was being charged or valved off or the space station. I often think of the astronauts that are up there unloading these things, you know, and bringing them into the space station. And they have to, you know, hook them up to the Quest lab, and, you know, that's the main supply where they pump oxygen and nitrogen into the space station. You know, they got to hook these things up. They're going to be right on top of it, you know. Meanwhile, they have the crew down below, 50 feet away, you know, with the protective cages all around them and everything. And here's these astronauts, you know, they unload these things from the Cygnus spacecraft, and that, you know, they're going to eventually hook them up. And one of the reasons it takes so long to unload things from, you know, from a spacecraft like that, you know, it'll stay attached to the space station for probably another month or so before it's totally unloaded and loaded up with more trash and sent off to be destroyed over the Pacific Ocean. I wanted to bring that up last week, and I never got around to it. Back to you, Dick. I'll talk more about the comets hitting the Earth if you want. This WS2N.
I'm getting a mental picture that's scaring me on this one, Cole. 6,000 pounds per square inch, I presume O2 tank and the N2 tank are both at 6,000 pounds per square inch. And in order to unload them, this cargo ship, Cygnus, I presume Cygnus has docked with the ISS. That means there's a great big opening between the ISS and the cargo hold of this Cygnus. If one of those tanks decides to let go, you're now going to get this huge overpressure of released either N2 or O2 roaring through that docking port between the Cygnus and the rest of the ISS. And you're going to literally inflate the whole ISS. Can you imagine what kind of a disaster that could be? Yes, maybe you're eventually going to mount the tank outdoors of the ISS. But to get it from the cargo hold to outdoors, doesn't that require an EVA? So there's a whole bunch of questions I've got here as to how you're going to use these high-pressure tanks and how reliable are they. And there was another question I was going to ask you, but that's enough for right now. That's a scary scenario. Oh, yes. I used to think that you brought up oxygen by way of bringing up water, and you do electrolysis of the water to get the oxygen back, and that's a more compact way of shipping the oxygen. WS2N, KQRIW, see if you can stop scaring me on what would happen if when you're unloading one of these tanks that decides to let go of you, Paul.
Yeah, you're right, they use the water, but again, it's not enough. You know, they need these tanks every now and then, but think about it, it's been like, 4 years now since the retirement of the space shuttle, and they used to do this on a regular basis. They used to bring the tanks up, were on the floor of the space shuttle, and then they would just hook up to wherever they're going to hook up and open valves. They used to do this, but they didn't have to move the tanks around, you know. They didn't have to take it out of the Cygnus and put it somewhere in the space station. You know, and they did this on a regular basis. And I know the pressures weren't as high as they are now. It's twice as high as this. You know, it used to be 3,000, now it's 6,000. But they're using the same tanks. When they retired the space shuttle, they went into the floor of the space shuttle and they disconnected these things and they brought them out. I think there was like 6 or 7 of these tanks in each space shuttle. So they took them out and they're actually utilizing them. Not like they got to make new ones. So, I'm trying to think of the acronym they have for. Well, NOES. I'll have to look it up. They call them North Tanks or something. That's the name for it. This way you can bring it up on the internet easy. Pictures and everything. And they look like, you know, little bombs. You know, short, fat, stubby looking. I don't see any handles on it. I don't even know how to grab this thing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Grab a hold of it. doesn't look like panels or welded to the thing. It looks like big. Back to you, Dick.
If I was on the International Space Station, when these things are being attached to the rest of the plumbing of the International Space Station, because you're connecting them to a tank, a system that has other tanks, the first thing I would do is drain some of the pressure out of these tanks, bringing the 6,000 down to 3,000, and dump the oxygen into the other tanks you've got available, which are, you know, partially empty. Because tanks of a significant age that used to be used at 3,000, and you're now using them at 6,000, and it's very similar to what happens when you pressurize the fuselage of a airliner. Each pressurization really is an inflation cycle where you're stressing and unstressing the aluminum in the case of a airliner. And you can only do that a certain number of times before you build up fatigue. So these tanks have been loaded and unloaded of their contents, stretched and unstretched some number of times, and now they're taking what used to be 3,000 and going to 6,000. My goodness, that sounds a little risky. What am I missing here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, they're going to bring them in and store them, in some location that I don't know of yet, but I know they're eventually going to be hooked up to, piped into the existing tanks around the Quest. If you look at the Quest lab, you know, that's where they go in, put your spacesuit on, and you do an EVA. On the outside of the Quest, there's these big tanks. I mean, they look like each one's got to be 4.5 feet diameter, and they surround the Quest lab, some oxygen, some of nitrogen, and I know that they're definitely going to be hooking up to those. So my guess is they'll probably bring the tanks into the Quest lab, and probably some kind of valve manifold. I would assume that they're going to have to, leave the tanks, just what you said. It's not like they're going to leave these tanks and every now and then open it up to feed the air in the ISS directly. They're going to be feeding the main support tanks. And then in turn, those tanks support the air in the Quest lab and through the rest of the space station.
6,000 pounds per square inch is roughly 400 atmospheres. So therefore, if one of those tanks should burst, whatever volume they've got is going to be released, and it's going to expand 400 times. That pressure wave inside of the ISS, boy, that sounds risky. The sooner they're on the outside, the better. There must be people losing a little sleep at night, wondering about these tanks. How many of them, roughly how big are they, Paul? And these things sound like they've been used on the shuttle for a good number of years. Maybe these things are one or two decades old, and they've been pressurized some significant number of times. And no matter what the tank is made out of, you can only pressurize it a certain number of times before you get metal fatigue or fiberglass fatigue, whatever they're made out of. Oh, you Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, they probably want to keep them light, so, maybe they're aluminum, lithium or something, I don't know. I don't think they're composite. I don't know what they're made of. But, it's normal, on Earth I used to handle the oxygen tanks, big green oxygen tanks, and they were 3,400 pounds. When they were fully loaded, when they'd come off the trucks, they had a big valve on top, and we'd roll those things around, and you were careful with them, but for some reason, if somehow that valve ever got sheared off instantaneously, they said it would easily go through a series of block walls. I mean, it would go off like a rocket. So imagine 6,000 pounds. Probably do a lot more damage than I just can't imagine it. But on a space station, I think it would definitely cause some kind of rupture within the inside of the space station if that thing ever was destroyed. But I know probably very careful with these things. They probably practice it many, many times. And, there's so much that goes on that we don't really see. You know, before they ever go up to the space station, they knew they were going to be moving these tanks years ago. So.
Got less than a minute to...
EVAs, and they all make it look easy. And, they'll have no problem, but it would be in the back of my mind, wow, 6,000 PSI and everything. Then when they tested them, they were going up to 10,000 on Earth, making sure that it could hold those pressures, by the way. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, the 10,000 test, proof testing, it sounds a little bit comforting. Thank goodness they passed that. This was SpaceNet, here we go. That was SpaceNet number 180, TechNet number 1581. Of the series 33 years ago that began. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. And John, when I pass it back to you, you work with some high-power, high-pressure tanks, oxygen and acetylene and whatever. I bet you've never seen pressures like 6,000 pounds. KT2WGB, K2RW. Good night, John, and over to you.
KT2WGB. Yeah, the highest I've seen is 5,000 pounds, 6,000. Ridiculous in test of intent. But don't forget, when they're testing on Earth, they have the confinement of the atmosphere helping them restrain those tanks. So the 10,000-pound test may be, depending on the size of the tank, that may be compensating for zero atmosphere up there, which relieves a lot of pressure up the outside of the tank. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us on the net and enjoy the questions that come in. And my email is on QRZ. If anybody has a question, they can send it in there. And thank everybody for being here. Good night, Dick, Paul, and everyone on the net. KC2WGB.
That was exciting stuff you gave us tonight, Paul. Bye-bye for now. Be careful. 6,000 pounds. I'm going to lose some sleep over that one, Paul.
Paul, you know, I don't know if you saw the one on... Mythbusters, they actually sheared off one of those valves and watched the nitrogen tank take off, and it did go through a cinder block wall with no concrete block wall, no problem.
I don't doubt it. Not at all. They use nitrogen. They used to come in. We think of nitrogen charges as well. I forgot the pressure they used to come in on. I remember the oxygen was 3,000. That was 3,200 and something like that. And the settling tanks were always 200. Back to you. John, back to you.
Why only 200 on the settling now, Paul? What do you think?
The ratio, the two tanks would be roughly empty at the same time. You ran 5 pounds, roughly 5 pounds on the settling, and then roughly 30 pounds on the oxygen. Is that right, John?
Yeah, that's about correct. Also, Paul, we didn't get them rated with PSI. We got them scale weight. The tanks had to weigh a certain amount. That's how you knew how much content was in them.
Yeah, that was the shipping people that worried about that. We just concerned ourselves with when you hooked it up to the gauges, what your reading was.
Toronto comment. Let's hear from Toronto. I'm going to guess this is VE3. One of those guys up there. Go right ahead, Toronto.
This is with CO2 at 700 and 9 degrees. 700 is standing at 70 degrees. Well, the rules across North America, every 5 years you have to hydro test the cylinder if you want to move it on a roadway or if you want to move it. So there's stringent rules about service, and you weigh them because the pressure to maintain a liquid doesn't matter the volume of the liquid in the tank. You're still going to have 700 PSI, whether you've got 10 pounds or 100 pounds. You weigh them to check that you haven't lost some of the weight. And the other thing, the bottles themselves are not that same. If you take a cylinder and test it at twice the pressure, they're probably doing more because they have to survive liftoff and everything. The most dangerous thing is when you're connecting, when you're opening a valve and you're connecting piping on oxygen, because I don't think they support the combustion. to explode, frostbite. Now, people would be frozen if you had that much liquid pressure released to atmosphere. The temperature would absorb the vaporize. It would be immense. So, you know, you'd be hurt by the force and frozen.
That's darn good information. Who are we talking to? You had a dropout when you gave us the call letters and name. I'm KQRIW. My name is Dick. Who are we talking to? And I thank you for the info. Back to you, sir.
Jim, as we talked before, Victor Echo 3, Juliet India Whiskey. My name is Juliet India Mike. I work with CO2 on fixed systems that protect rooms and mainly machines. You don't protect occupied rooms with CO2 because it 10% kills people. No, at 10% you collapse. So, I've never had a fear of bottles. So I walked into where bottles are very rusty on the bottom. And I say to people, we're not moving them, we're emptying them before we move them. They don't comply with the code. Nobody's going to get hurt. And I've not had any incidents with bottles. They're tested before they get old. You know, I don't think that's one of the biggest problems NASA has. It's the mass of the thing, the mass of it. It may not weigh anything, but it's still got the mass to deal with.
Yeah, we talked to you quite a few times, Jim, from the Golden Horseshoe, as I remember. In the case of CO2 in a high-pressure container, I'm going to make a guess the CO2 might be in solid form inside the container. Therefore, weighing is the only way you can find out how much is there, because if there's any vapor above the solid mass, it's always going to be at the same pressure, assuming the temperature is the same. But in the case of oxygen or nitrogen, I don't think what's in those tanks is in solid form. I'm guessing it's in gaseous form. But am I close to correct that the CO2 in your containers, Jim, was possibly in solid form inside the container? VE3JIW, K2RIW in the deck net.
Well, it's still a liquid. It's still a liquid. Now realize, when you drop the temperature of a container, when you drop the temperature, the pressure is going to drop, and temperature and pressure are a constant. So depending how, you know, those are 6,000, if you're going to say it's 6,000 psi on Earth, you can work it backwards. The CO2 is 700 pounds at 70, it's 300 psi at zero, zero Fahrenheit. Pretty sure of that, but no, it's still a liquid. At 70 Fahrenheit, 700 psi, it is still a liquid. There is no supercharging. There's no nitrogen or added gases to raise the pressure to force the gas to move fast, the liquid to move faster up the tube through the valve. And they use a tube so you get liquid. There's a type of tube at the bottom so that if you open the valve, you get liquid, not vapor. But I'm guessing the oxygen, if you cool it down, you're going to get a substantial drop in pressure.
Now, here I'm a little bit fuzzy in my memory. I remember a compressed tank of something, I'm not sure if it was nitrogen or CO2, which you would hook up to a environmental testing chamber, and by way of letting the gas escape into the chamber, you created cooling. That's how you got to refrigeration temperatures. The tanks that do that in environmental testing chambers, is that compressed nitrogen or compressed CO2? VE3JIW, K2RIW.
And Dick, this WS Planet, if you remember, if they were orange, they were nitrogen.
I think they were green, but I'm not sure. Over to you, Jim.
Green would be oxygen.
I don't know about the specific heat of one gas to another. The CO2 is, well, CO2 could be safer than nitrogen because you can scan for it in the room. So if you get too much by concentration, you don't, it's easier, maybe it's easier to measure for CO2 than it is for that low oxygen level. CO2 being heavier than air would take a while to asphyxiate people. They might have used CO2 because it's easier to measure than nitrogen. You can't look for high nitrogen, you'd have to look for low oxygen, whereas if you're adding CO2, you can have either you have, you know, a CO2 monitor, or you've got to check for enough oxygen to support life. That's the problem, if you know. A pound of CO2 displaces 7 cubic feet. So it doesn't take a lot, you know, depending on the size of the room. I'm guessing they'd pick a gas that they could easily detect and was less lethal, either because it replaces oxygen, displaces the oxygen in the room, or it inhibits life. CO2 at 10%, you will pass out. So you haven't lost, you haven't drastically lost the oxygen content.
It's beginning to sound like those bottles were CO2. What is the color that a CO2 bottle is painted? Over to you, Jim.
There's my experience with fire systems. They're painted red, but the extinguishers that are for CO2 are, I've seen ones for bars, and they're not red. They have a label. They're often chrome, so I'm not sure of the non-firefighting color for a CO2 cylinder.
Do you ever use CO2? I guess you don't, because it's used for cooling an environmental chamber. I vaguely remember those containers were either a deep green or a gray. They were not a bright color. They certainly weren't yellow. They weren't red. Deep green or a gray, as I remember these cylinders. The cylinder itself was, approximately 5 feet high. I would say it's about, 10 or 12 inches in diameter. And if you opened up the valve pretty fast, you could make, the cooling you got was so fast you could make snow. You probably never used CO2. Is that true, Paul, WS2N, K2LAW?
Not the tanks, but I think they'd probably be red tanks. The ones you were talking about, the valve and everything froze up on you. You know, you create a lot of force and everything. That was probably a nitrogen tank that you're describing. CO2 systems, I remember working on piping, and had a lot of it had to be welded and everything because it involved CO2 because they had pressures up to 1,200, you know, it was for fire protection. Now where people would be, you know, for machinery and things like that, people are around and, you know, they really want to go with water. CO2 will collect and like who is it, Jim said, cause a problem for people.
Do you think you would have it? Yeah, I think Jim said the CO2 is heavier than air, so as long as the people are up off the floor, they have a certain degree of safety. Glenn, go right ahead. Have you used bottles of CO2 and steel bottles, and what color were they for running an environmental chamber? You've run environmental chambers, so you probably remember seeing those steel bottles. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, usually, Dick, the liquid nitrogen usually comes in a chrome-looking or stainless steel type container with brass valves, and the steel canisters or whatever, like the five-footers, usually, I've seen them painted all different colors, from gray and green and things of that nature, but I think at one time they were color-coded, but now what they do is they have the MSDS tags that go on the side that mark what's actually in the container with the toxicity of whatever the material is inside. So ever since MSDS, I think they've kind of gotten away from the color coding of the tanks to the material as MSDS came out. Right here.
Hey, Derek. Go ahead, Eric. I bet you've used high-pressure CO2 from time to time. You've got it, Eric.
My only experience with CO2 was in carbonation machines, and they're usually silver tanks. But I use a lot of nitrogen tanks. They come loaded at about anywhere between 3,200 and 3,500 psi.